Nothing is more expensive than bad information. Know the source. OneRadioNetwork.com. Good morning. This is OneRadioNetwork.com. The telephone number is 888-663-6386. Email patrick@OneRadioNetwork.com. Here's your host, Patrick Timpone.
Well, good morning, and I think we're going to make it here. We have our internet munchkins working on everything, and I think it's fine. If you should get any dropouts, it'll be brief, and then we're going to have the complete podcast. But I think we're on pretty much track here. It's just a kind of a karmic thing when you have something you really want to do. You know, sometimes the karmic angels push back a little bit, but it's just planet Earth, and that's Dr. Thomas Cowan. Really nice man. We've had him on the show two or three times now, and he began his holistic medical practice in 85 and went through various different places. And he's really questioned the connections between diet and health and true healing and how this whole amazing system works. On his website here, Fourfold Healing, reading just a little bit. He's done a lot of study and work and research and Rudolf Steiner and Weston I. Price and herbology, homeopathy, and things like that. And then sometimes along the way, he turned on to this idea that the heart is not a pump. And we've been talking about that, which is fascinating indeed. And have some videos on some websites we can turn you on to. I think it's called New Heart something. Well, we'll do that. Anyway, with Dr. Thomas Cowan out of San Francisco. Dr. Cowan, thanks for being here. Good morning. How are things by the city by the bay?
Things are good, and it's nice to be here. Thank you for having me.
Well, it's a pleasure. It's a pleasure, sir. I saw, too, I'm pretty excited, you got your new ramp powder coming back. See, so I'm all a Twitter about that. We'll give you a few plugs on that.
Yeah, thank you.
Really, really good stuff. I have a whole counter full of your powders, Doc. I'm one of your best customers. I love them.
Great.
I just love them. I think not only the taste and the nutrition, but I just think that what you're doing with them needs to be supported as much as we can, because it's really cool stuff, and we're going to tell folks about them. We have a lot of new listeners, too. So, Dr. Thomas Cowan, I had an email from somebody I wanted to ask you about. Pretty well-researched guy, evidently. He said, I believe that the work of a Dr. Rodermont way back in the late 1800s was one of the first people to talk about the heart is not a pump thing. Do you know about this fellow?
No.
No, you never heard of him, huh? I'll be darned.
I never heard of him.
Rodermont, Rodermunt. Huh.
No.
Yeah, maybe you'll Google him sometime and see if he
was. Yeah.
Yeah. How did you first, get involved with this kind of research and work, the heart is not a pump?
I joined the Peace Corps basically after college, being pretty disenchanted with with everything that I had learned or not learned up to that point. I had no idea what to do, and I decided to teach gardening in Southern Africa. I mean, I didn't really decide that, but that's my job. And so there I was, and I go to this little town, not a town, it's like a place, and with just a bunch of homesteads. And the only other expatriate in the place was a guy who was a Zimbabwean biodynamic farmer who came to Swaziland to escape military service. And so there the two of us were together starting this garden, and he gave me a whole bunch of books on Rudolf Steiner, because I never heard of the guy or anything. And that just made a lot of sense to me. And then I eventually joined the growing anthroposophical doctors movement in the United States, and we had conferences for a week every year in New Hampshire. And that's where I heard that Rudolf Steiner said one of the fundamental ideas that people need to appreciate is that the heart does not pump the blood.
Oh.
That's an overly mechanistic way of looking at the human being, And besides that, it's wrong.
Besides everything else, this is wrong, huh?
Yeah, so that got me interested. It was interesting as time went on, because my sense was even the German doctors who were more steeped in anthroposophy, they just couldn't explain it. They couldn't explain why it was, you know, that the heart isn't a pump. And if the heart isn't a pump, then what moves the blood? In fact, I heard no explanation for that. And as time went on, my sense was that people actually thought, like I hear a lot from other non-anthroposophical type of people, oh yeah, the heart is a pump, the heart pumps the blood, but it's also a spiritual organ or an organ of love or mm-hmm. organ of perception or mm-hmm. electro field, you know, a lot of things. It's a neuroendocrine organ. All those things are true. It is all those things. But primarily, it's not a pump. And the problem is, if you think, yes, the organ is an organ of love, for instance, mm-hmm. the people say that, mm-hmm. And you think it's a pump, there's no way you can explain how it becomes an organ of love. In fact, the whole thing, obviously it's my opinion, it's basically nonsense, because you're saying it's a mechanistic, organ, and that the circulation works in a mechanistic way. So you believe in this mechanistic worldview, and so there's no way that there, like, it's like I say, if you're a surgeon and you're doing a heart transplant and you open up the heart, there's no place you find love in there.
Unless you love your work, I guess. Unless you love your heart.
Yeah, but it's not physically in your heart.
Yeah, yeah.
Obviously.
Of course.
And even, you know, when people say the heart is made of gold or you have a heart of gold,
mm-hmm.
There's no gold in the heart. You know, you can dissect the heart, you know, cell by cell, and you're not going to find any love or gold. And so those two things, gold and love, have a different connection to the heart. Now, when you appreciate how the heart works, really, which is not as a pump, you start to understand why it is that people associate heart with love and gold and all those things.
You figured it out.
Yeah, well, I mean...
I know. I'm just being silly. Yeah, yeah.
But anyway, so that's how I got into it. And I would also, you know, for anybody who's hearing this and saying, oh, this is nuts, you know, first time, I would point out that there's essentially, at least in the English-speaking world, I don't know about the German-speaking world, so it may be different, but in the English-speaking world, there's essentially two people who are talking about this. There's me, and there's a guy named Bronco First. And Bronco First is an anesthesiologist, upstate medical, and he wrote a book called Circulation in Something Integrative Approach or
mm-hmm.
something.
Mm-hmm.
And one of his articles is reprinted on my website. And he's essentially saying the same thing, except in much more technical language,
uh-huh.
like with pressure differentials. And all the things, you know, his business is, you know, putting people on heart-lung machines. So he knows something about the fluid dynamics of the heart, right? I mean, that's his job.
Mm-hmm.
And so he can look at it from that point of view and essentially prove to any cardiologist or cardiac physiologist that there's no way the heart pumps the blood. And interestingly, he wrote this book, which... you know, I sometimes say is only for the scientific faint of heart, because it's a tough read. But, you know, so even me, and I don't mean even me,
yeah,
like
I understand,
I'm some,
yeah.
you know, I, but it's tough to read. But, you know, I read it probably five times, and I think I get it. So his book was endorsed by the head of cardiac anesthesiology and the head of pediatric cardiac anesthesiology at Harvard Medical School. And they said that anybody who this is the reason why we have no better outcomes with congestive heart failure than we did 50 years ago, because we don't understand how the heart works, and we don't understand why the blood circulates in the body. And people who believe that the heart is a pump, it's like believing in Newtonian physics. Like, nobody believes that anymore, right? We've moved on to quantum physics. But yet, people, you know, will deride me or say this is nonsense, or we already know the heart is a pump. And yet they have no clue, really, that this is outdated. It never was correct in the first place, but, you know.
Yeah, I understand. Gotcha. Dr. Thomas Cowan is here if you care to join the show. Patrick@OneRadioNetwork.com. Could it be on the whole love thing, just for fun, Doc, if you go to the Chinese medicine, you know, where all the different organs are at different times of the day, the heart building time and the heart cleansing time is between 11 a.m. and 1, and then the kidney, of course, is fear, and the liver is anger, and what's the lungs? Grief. Maybe the heart has been tied in some emotional thing on that level. I don't know. Possible?
Yeah.
I know.
I mean, I talk about in my book, you know,
Cosmic Heart. You have Human Heart, yeah. Cosmic Heart, your latest book.
I talk about my take on the association with the heart and love.
Mm-hmm.
Because the heart is very much tied up with the essence of your personality.
Yeah.
And sometimes called the ego. But the way I know that is because there are very interesting stories of people who get heart transplants who take on the actual personality of the person whose heart they receive.
Really?
Sometimes in very strange ways. There was a story I told of this sort of kind of, quote, redneck-y guy who you know, basically, was kind of a racist and hung out in the bars. And he ends up getting an anonymous heart transplant from a young black guy. And next thing you know, he's like a totally different person.
Really?
And much more friendly to his African-American friends. And the strange thing about it, because they don't know anything about the donor, he starts liking to listen to classical music, you know, and this is a guy who had nothing to do with any of that stuff. And they couldn't understand this. They eventually found out, as young African Americans, so the thing about the liking, stopping being a racist, maybe made more sense. It turns out the guy who the donor was shot on the way to his classical violin training lesson.
Wow!
So
pretty cool,
you know. And there's lots of stories. There's a whole book. A guy named Lawrence LeShawn wrote a book because his job was counseling people undergoing heart transplants.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
So, and then there's other reasons why.
Yeah. You've talked to us a lot about the idea of myocardial infarction, which is just like, you can explain what that is, and then also this atherosclerosis, right, where the arteries get clogged up, and then people go in and do stents and all that, and these are all kind of termed, I guess, as, oh, Joe had a heart attack, right? They just usually clump them into that, right? But nobody really knows or says, or I don't know if they know. How do you know what the percentage would be of where the heart just kind of does the myocardial infarction? And maybe you'll explain to us, like we're a young child or golden retriever, what that is and the difference between where the arteries really get clogged up and does that actually cause a heart attack itself?
So myocardial infarction is just another word for heart attack.
Okay.
Technical
mm-hmm.
word.
Mm-hmm.
It means that essentially the death of the heart cells due to decreased blood flow. So that's what the term means. I think what you're asking about, of course, is what causes myocardial infarction. Now, everybody or heart attacks. Now everybody essentially thinks they know that. They say, well, we have these three major coronary arteries, and they get blocked with plaque, and so people argue about why that happens, whether it's high-fat or low-fat diets or whatever.
Whatever.
But anyways, somehow you get blocked with plaque, the blood can't get through, and then downstream from that blockage, the area doesn't get enough blood flow, and then it dies, and that's called a heart attack. And so everybody believes that, and then the argument is about what to do about that. And so you have everything from statin drugs to bypass surgery, so you essentially put a new artery in, or a new vein into that, or you open it up with a stent, you put like a Roto-Rooter in there, and then you put a stent in there to hold it open, or you go on a low-fat diet or a paleo diet, or you do chelation to, you know, bind and excrete that plaque. But my point is, everybody is arguing about and interested in the plaque, and that's why we do stents and bypasses.
Mm-hmm.
And I would point out, I can't get the exact numbers, but I think stents and bypasses and cardiac catheterization, where we put dye and look at the arteries, that's the main revenue source for most of the hospitals in the United States. We're talking well over $50 billion a year. And yet, in 2004, there was an article in the New England Journal called the COURAGE Study, which looked at the outcomes of stents and bypasses, and basically said what we've been able to see is, or demonstrate, is that stents and bypasses don't prolong people's lives, they don't prevent further heart attacks, and they don't prevent further hospitalizations, but they do relieve chest pain. And so at that point, the only indication you could do a stent or a bypass is somebody with pain, because you can't tell them this is going to stop you from having another heart attack, which is curious, because that's the whole point, basically. And then, interestingly, in 2017, in October, in The Lancet, that for the first time, they actually did a double-blind study of stents to see if they did relieve pain. So they took, you know, 100 people with chest pain, angina, caused supposedly by decreased blood flow through this blockage. Then half of them, they put a stent in. The other half, they did a catheterization, pulled it out, told them they put a stent in, but they didn't, and saw what happened. 8 weeks later, they had the same amount of chest pain. And the New York Times ran an article on this, and The Atlantic also ran a magazine article, and basically the headline was "Stents Proven Useless." Because if they don't relieve chest pain, and they don't prevent heart attacks, and they don't make you live longer, and they don't prevent hospitalizations, it's hard to come up with an assessment or an idea of what this, you know, $500 billion or $50 billion, or I don't know what the number is, thing is doing for us.
And more importantly, why a man would allow, or a woman would allow that to happen.
You mean a patient?
Yeah, a patient would make that decision.
Well, patients are told if you don't, you got a blocked artery.
You're going to die.
If you're going to die if you don't have this.
Okay, so let me try to understand though. So, is a theory that's out there in conventional medicine that the hearts get, you know, the arteries get blocked up, and eventually less and less and less and less blood flow, and eventually then one day you're at work and all of a sudden, boom, you have a heart attack because it closed up or something. They go in, but in your opinion, is this the heart muscle slowly dying or deteriorating as blood flow lessens? Or is that one of the causes why you can have a myocardial infarction? The less blood flow?
Well, not exactly. And what the reason I got interested in this, and the website that you referred to is called heartattacknew.com.
That's the one, yeah. Heartattacknew, yeah. Right.
And I know that fellow who has the website. It's a brilliant website. And at the bottom of it, there's this, something called a print version. And one of the things that's printed, and again, this is not for the faint of heart, so to speak, but is a reprint of a book by an Italian pathologist named Baroldi, who studied by doing autopsies on people who died of heart attacks for 40 years, thousands and thousands of them. And that's the only way you can actually find out why did these people die.
Mm-hmm.
And so the conclusion, to summarize, you know, 200 plus pages of research, but is that about 41% of people who die of a heart attack have a blocked artery. And of those 41%, half of them, the blockage comes after the heart attack, not before.
Wow.
So the question that leaves exactly 80% of people who have a heart attack don't have a significant blockage in their artery. And I can tell you, even though they won't admit it or say it, every cardiologist knows that. So the question then is, what caused that 80% of the people to die of a heart attack?
Yes.
If they didn't have a blocked artery?
Yeah.
Now, in this Atlantic article on the uselessness of stents, they interviewed a cardiologist actually at UCSF in San Francisco, and she said something very interesting, which, as I said over and over again, I almost fell off my chair when I read this, because she said this article will bring home the point to patients and cardiologists that focal blockages are not the disease, and that there is a diffuse systemic disease underlying these blockages, and that is the cause of the heart attacks. Now, I've never in my career heard a cardiologist say, oh, well, you have a blockage, but that's not really the problem. You have some diffuse systemic disease that's really the problem, and the blockage is only a manifestation of that. But that's what she said.
Did she conjecture what this diffuse disease is?
No.
Oh. Hmm.
And that's what I did an interview the next week or whatever, and because I have an impish streak in me, I said, everybody should wake up tomorrow and ask their cardiologist, what is my diffuse systemic disease that you're treating here? Because I've never heard any cardiologist that I know of mention that there is such a thing. And essentially, that's what I wrote this book about, because I have very specific ideas. Obviously, I didn't make these up myself, but it's very clear what at least some of the components of this diffuse systemic disease are. So one of them is a suppressed parasympathetic nervous system. Mm. And we know this from heart rate variability testing. And this comes because of stress and poor diet and lack of exercise and high blood pressure, diabetes, smoking. All these things depress your parasympathetic nervous system.
Depress your para, that's the one where we relax and chill out and get digestion. Now, let me stop you there for a second. When that is getting depressed, is it actually affecting, in your opinion, the muscles of the heart itself and it causing stress on those muscles?
It affects the metabolism of the heart cells.
Ooh.
You see, this is a heart as an organ problem, and only peripherally as a blood supply to the heart problem. Now, obviously, those two are related and can be related, but they're not the same thing. The problem, and that's the reason why I've had literally scores, if not hundreds, of people who come to me and say, yeah, I'm mostly fine. I was walking up a hill and I didn't feel so good. And I went to the cardiologist and he said I had a 95% blockage in one of my major arteries. And if it blocks anymore, I'm going to die of a heart attack. And if you dissect that for a minute, in other words, this guy who's mostly fine, not totally, but he has 5% blood flow to his heart. And first of all, how did he walk up that hill with 5% blood flow? And second of all, you mean to say if it blocks from 5 to like 2 or 3 or 1, that's going to kill him? I mean, the fact of the matter is if you got 5% blood flow, you've got no blood flow. And so even then, there's literally millions of people walking around with stenosis in their heart of over 90% who don't even know it.
Stenosis meaning blockage.
Blockage, yeah.
Okay, blockage.
So how is that How is that even possible? Some of them will never have a problem. And it's because that's only one of the factors. And it can, I'm not saying it's good to have blocked arteries.
Of course.
That's not, you know, and there are 20% of the time, and there's certain lesions, like in the left anterior descending artery, that seem to be not good places to have plaque.
Mm-hmm.
But it's not, that's not sufficient reason. It has to go through these three things that I'm talking about. So the first is the parasympathetic nervous system.
Right.
The second is the collateral blood flow. You know, the, as I've said over and over again, the heart is not, the body is not so stupid to put all its eggs in these three baskets. So if you look at, you know, if you go to Heart Attack New and you go to the frequently asked questions and the Riddle solution, Figure 1, you'll see what the normal blood flow to the heart looks like, which is a extensive network of small blood vessels, so that the blood flow is more like a watershed or a wetlands than it is a river. And that's a much more redundant and safe and, you know, well-designed operation than just having, if this one gets blocked, then you're done. And the collateral circulation is mainly affected by diabetes, which we know is a disease of the small blood vessels. Like diabetes doesn't make you form plaque, but it corrodes your small blood vessels, and they provide the bulk of the blood flow to the heart, not these major arteries.
All the little vessels around the big major arteries.
Right. So you do your own bypass, essentially. and that's why, you know, every doctor knows diabetics get heart disease. But it doesn't make sense, because diabetics don't generally get plaque. They just get, so what's the cause of their heart disease? They don't have any more plaque that I know of than anybody else, but they definitely have small vessel disease. That's why they have eye problems. That's why they have kidney problems. That's why they have foot problems.
It's the same principle all throughout the body, same principle.
Yes. They have small vessel disease, and if you have small vessel disease in your heart, that's, you can't, you know, bring nutrients and get rid of waste products. And then the third and the biggest reason, and the one that nobody says anything about, but which has been documented and proven for, you know, 70, 80 years, a guy, Manfred von Arden something, he was East German or one of those Eastern European companies who started oxygen therapy, the reason there was oxygen bars in the 60s and all that, and people, you know, breathing oxygen and exercising and all this. He was able to, for first time that I know of, document that everybody who has a heart attack has a buildup of lactic acid in the myocardial or heart cell. Myocardial means heart cells. And the way that happens, which is actually interestingly pretty much identical to the way that it happens in cancer, so this is a systemic disease, is there's poor parasympathetic tone, there's poor microcirculation, there's a poor mitochondrial function in the heart cells. The heart cells have the most mitochondria of any cells in the body. And just like the mitochondria, we think now probably are at least strongly associated with the formation of cancer, because if there's something wrong with the mitochondrial function, because of a whole lot of reasons, I don't need to get into that, then you end up using glycolysis or fermentation to generate energy instead of respiration. And that's like the same thing that happens in your leg. If your leg cells aren't healthy, if you're not getting blood flow, if you're not in good shape, when you exceed your capacity, you'll go anaerobic. You'll start fermenting energy, that builds up lactic acid and you get a cramp in your leg. Same thing happens in your heart. If you don't have a good microcirculation, if you don't have a good parasympathetic nervous system, if you have mitochondrial disease, which most people do have, then you exceed your capacity, you start fermenting, you build up lactic acid, and you get cramp and pain in your heart, same as your leg, and we call that angina. The difference between your leg and your heart is your leg stops because you don't need to move your leg for 10 minutes if you don't want to. And then the blood flushes out the lactic acid and it goes away. Your heart can't stop, so the lactic acid continues to build up, and that causes a localized tissue acidosis, which prevents the calcium from getting into the cell, which paralyzes the muscle, which creates shear pressure on the artery inside that muscle, which breaks off little pieces of the plaque, and all that causes the heart attack. It's the breakdown of the cells from the acidification of the tissue that causes, that's what we call a heart attack. So it's very clear, and it even answers the question of why do these blockages happen after the heart attack? The answer is because there's acidification of the tissue, and then you can't, the heart can't move properly. That creates pressure on the arteries, which break off pieces, which is what they're seeing after the heart attack. So those are the three reasons why people have heart attacks, and none of them is directly related to the plaque.
So say a fellow has chest pains, as it's commonly here all the time. They get rushed to the doctor. The next thing you know, they're getting stents, and you know they do the whole thing because the doc thinks, well, that's the problem. What could that a person, knowing what you know, what could they do at that moment rather than do the stents and the whole thing? Do they have any options at that point?
Well, the first thing they should have done, and maybe, and if they can just take a minute to, you know, just a lot of times it's not as much of an emergency as it's made out to be. I'm not saying there's sometimes it is an emergency,
right,
because
yeah,
it is. But
people feel really badly, and they feel like they're going to, you know, like, I've never felt it, but I've heard people tell me about it, and they said, man, I just thought I was going to die.
Yeah, well, then you have to go to the ER.
Yeah.
But if it's, you know, a step before that, you know, without meaning to be self-serving here, but the first thing I think they should do is get and read my book. And in there, I talk about, you know, so those are the three problems.
Yes, we got, parasympathetic arteries and lactic acid, right?
Right. So they all need to be addressed. And so there's two things I would point out. One is that I wouldn't say introduced, because the medicine has been around for a century. And you know, in 1940 and 1950 in Germany and in the United States, if you went to the hospital in that situation, they would give you a IV treatment with a medicine called G-strophanthine.
Mm-hmm.
And G-strophanthine is the active ingredient of a plant called Strophanthus gratus, which is an African perennial vine, which makes seeds which have this chemical called G-strophanthine in Europe and wabain in the United States. And wabain has basically three effects. One is it supports the parasympathetic nervous system. Two, it increases the microcirculation. And three, and most importantly, at least in my opinion, it converts lactic acid into pyruvate, which the heart uses as a fuel instead of a poison. And so the whole cycle is broken. And, you know, even up until the 80s in German hospitals, Swiss hospitals, that was the treatment for people with angina or impending heart attacks.
They would go in the hospital, actually, or emergency, and they'd give them this this herb.
Yeah, it was. If your doctor is over 70, he'll remember it.
Wow.
And And then they, you know, would give him oral capsules, and the heart attack and angina rate was dramatically less. And there's a number of studies over the years demonstrating this with basically no toxicity, because it's actually it's a endogenous product. In other words, we make G-strophanthine in our adrenal cortex, just like the Chinese say, the kidneys nourish the heart. Well, I think the actual connection is the adrenal cortex makes G-strophanthine or wobbine, same name, and that goes to the heart if needed and flushes out the poison, and, you know, you're on your way.
Good for us. Good for us.
And so that's the sort of emergency thing. Now, we started a program after I published this book because there is only one, you know, over the years with the emphasis on the coronary artery disease, and they said, oh, strophanthus, you know, wobbine doesn't work, or it's not absorbed, or they gave all kinds of reasons. And so there's nobody making it anymore, and there's only this this herb company from Brazil, and that's what we use. So, you know, we're asking people to, you know, go on our website and find a practitioner they can work with, and we can teach them how to do it. And just last month, this month, actually, May, in Townsend Letter, I published an article with six or seven case studies of people with angina, with congestive heart failure, with lowered ejection fractions, who improved just through the use of strophanthus.
So folks could go to their doctor and do a thing, and they could work with you and hook them up and work with this this herb.
Yes.
Oh, cool. Is this herb ever used on, quote, healthy folks for preventative or at all, or is it always used when there is an issue?
I mean, you know, I do these sort of weekly strophanthus calls.
Do you?
You know, and people, you know, anywhere from one to last week there was 15 or so doctors or naturopaths call in, and they always ask, appropriately enough, what about people with just depressed parasympathetic?
Yeah, that's a good question. A lot of people have that, right? Yeah.
Yeah, a lot of people have that. Mm-hmm. Or people with like leg cramps from lactic acid buildup.
Right. Mm-hmm.
The interesting thing, in my opinion, is it doesn't work for either one of those.
Oh.
It doesn't work for leg cramps. It's very specific to the heart.
How about for the para? Does it help the para get more happy?
You know, like if somebody has no heart problems and just sort of anxious and, you know, that whole parasympathetic suppression, I think there's better adaptogens than strophanthus.
Okay. All right. Well.
So it seems to be, you know, like Steiner's worldview was, you know, like in a nutshell, there's a lot of.
Yeah,
but basically, the in the beginning was one, or in the beginning was the human being, but didn't look like what people look like today. Just everything, and then over time, the extraneous bits were chipped off, if you want to use that word, and became the other kingdoms and species in nature,
mm-hmm.
which is a strange way of looking at it. But so here you are, like imagine like a big jellyfish, and then you don't want this part, so you chip it off, and that becomes granite. Or you don't want this part, and that becomes dandelion. And you don't want this part, but when those things in nature were formed, they still retain a connection with the organ that was formed when that plant or animal or mineral was formed.
I totally get that. I think he's, I don't know, I get that. I see that.
You know what's interesting about that?
I see that. I mean, how could it be any other way?
Yeah, so you know, the digitalis plant is the heart in nature. Now, interestingly, when I think it was Michelangelo was asked, you know, how did you sculpt this statue of David? You know, how did you do that? He said, well, I took this, you know, I'm paraphrasing here, but I took this piece of granite, and David lived in the granite. So I just chipped away the extraneous bits, and there he was.
There he was. That's great.
And so Strophanthus, according to Steiner, was formed at the time of the creation of the human heart. Now, people have to see that as a imagination, not like, oh, one day to the next, there wasn't a heart, and then there was a heart.
Sure.
Like,
yeah.
We're talking about the sort of mind or spiritual impulse that isn't related to time, and it's not like one day the heart appeared. That's nonsense. But it is, and so healing is essentially, you know, you look at a human being, and they need to be reunited with some heart plant or some, you know, plant that is related to some other thing, Venus or something. And so you take that plant and you reunite it with the human being and you make them whole again.
Oh.
That's what we're talking about here.
Yeah, that's nice. Yeah.
And so that's one way. Now, there's also a technique. So you can go from anywhere from this sort of kind of sublime, some people would say nonsense, but whatever, esoteric way of looking at the world. And then you can bring it down to, okay, the problem is you don't have good enough microcirculation. So I'm going to do something called EECP, which stands for Enhanced External Counterpulsation, which is a very mechanical thing. You put the person on a bed and you put squeezy balloons on their legs and their pelvis, and it's synchronized with the EKG so that when your heart is relaxed, it pushes more blood up to your heart. And the pressure of the pushing of the blood to your heart makes your heart sprout new micro vessels, new capillaries in your heart.
That sounds good.
Yeah, so you end up with a new microcirculation, which then essentially does its own bypass. And the amazing thing about this is, you know, there are studies that show that 80% of the people who do EECP, nothing else, they don't change their diet, they don't exercise, they don't take Strophanthus, they don't do anything, they just do EECP, 80% of their chronic angina symptoms go away, they have less heart attacks and less hospitalization.
And
Medicare pays for it.
And are there docs around, I guess, that have this EECP contraption in their office and you can do it?
There are some.
Mm-hmm. Not a lot, huh?
But not a lot. And you say, why not? You know, I've had so many people go to their cardiologist or whatever. Mm-hmm. What about EECP? I read about it in Cowan's book, you know.
Right.
And I went on the internet on PubMed, and there's that study saying 80% of the people just like me have complete remission of their symptoms, and all I have to do is sit here in a bed. And by the way, you know, like if you're a marathon runner and you want to shave like 10 seconds off your time,
mm-hmm.
this will do it because you get in better shape. It's sometimes called passive exercise because it increases your, you know, vascular capacity.
Cool.
So it's good for you.
Would anyone, regardless of their shape, healthy or not, benefit from an EECP session, do you think?
Yeah, it's not one session. You do it 5 times a week for 7 or 8 weeks.
Oh, my goodness.
Yeah.
That's a lot.
I mean, I would do it.
Would you? Just for fun? You'd do it?
I mean, not for fun, because I don't think it's much fun. But
but you would do it if you... Yeah.
Absolutely. If there was a place here and I wanted to spend 2 hours a day for, you know... I do, you know, if somebody brought it in my house and set it
you
up...
You would do it, right?
I would do it. Why? Because I would end up having a more robust microcirculation. I'd have less... I don't have chest pain, but I'd have more endurance and better exercise tolerance.
There's a lot of folks out there that suggest that when we do these burst kind of things where you run in place like a saber-toothed tiger's after you for 30 seconds or whatever, that it really builds up the heart, burst kind of ideas. Do you think that's valid? Do you think there's something to that?
Yes, but I also think that in certain scenarios that I've actually experienced with patients, they end up damaging their heart through too much high intensity strength training.
Ooh.
I think, generally speaking, that's a good strategy, but there's sometimes when one has to be a little cautious with that.
Yeah. Go ahead.
I mean, the trouble is, you know, like if you talk to a cardiologist and you say, why don't you have people do this sort of high intensity or strength training, or, I mean, most of the people who they're dealing with, you know, they can't hardly even walk across the room.
Right, yeah.
So that's where EECP is very helpful, because you have somebody who, you know, has angina practically at rest, and they can't do anything. So all they have to do is lay on this bed, and in 7 weeks they'll be able to walk, you know, 2 miles. And in which case, at that point, then they can start building up their endurance.
Hmm. If somebody was doing too much, could they have some clues or some feelings ahead of time, rather than going to some big problems? Or, I mean, how would they even know?
Well, if you don't recover quickly and you feel exhausted with exercise,
then that's a sign, right?
That's a sign. And then if you keep going and you start getting edema in your legs and feet, that's a problem.
Sure.
Then you've gone too far.
But if everything's cool and you just feel great afterwards, and generally you're probably in pretty good shape. So I want to. Can you stick around a few more minutes?
Sure.
Oh, because I'm having fun. Okay. Let's. I want to plug some of your products here. Let's do an infomercial. I mean, this is not planned, but I want to do one. Dr. Cowan has got these great products, and we have a little link on our page. It's not about us or making commissions, but this is really cool stuff. You don't have to go through our thing. I don't care. DrCowan'sGarden.com, but we do have a link, and he has these powders. And Doc, you dehydrate these different powders from vegetables that we just don't normally get, like from the hippie food store, broccoli and things, right?
Yeah, you know, the whole idea of the company was to diversify people's vegetable consumption, because to me it's not about eating like a pound of broccoli a day. That's, you know, you don't need that many of the nutrients from broccoli, but you need broccoli and carrots and onions and beets and, you know, you name it.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
So if you get a little bit of each, that's good. And so that's a hard thing to do for most people. So we take these and, you know, we get them organically grown, hopefully even beyond organically grown. Sometimes even we're hoping to do more biodynamic produce, dehydrate them. And they become very easy to use, no more difficult than eating Kellogg's cornflakes. You just sprinkle them on food. You can make things. We have all these recipes. And then we wanted to get into things that are more difficult for people to get. Like, there's a good argument that, you know, over the years, the history of gardening and agriculture has been taking wild foods that are low in sugar and high in phytonutrients, that's plant-based nutrients, and turning that into high in sugar and low in nutrients. And the reason is because it tastes better to some people. They don't want to eat bitter or, you know, strong-tasting food. They want to eat sugar. I mean, or at least they think they do. So they selected and bred progressively, so that now, you know, Americans eat a high sugar, low nutrient diet. So my idea was to try to figure out a way to bring back, you know, some wild foods or perennial vegetables or foods that, even in San Francisco, like the food mecca of the world, you just can't go to the farmer's market and get wild ramps or choya buds or tree collards or genera procumbens. People mostly haven't even heard of those, but you like you know, wild ramps are an extremely nutritious food. They have amazing taste. And Choya buds act like an anti-diabetic drug. They were Native American, you know, like they're the buds of cactus or something like that.
Yeah.
So we're trying to make those available to anybody, you know, and not have to go and forage or, not that I have anything against people foraging, but it's pretty hard sometimes.
When you dehydrate them and put them in these Myron glass jars, beautiful little black jars, is it virtually as good as eating the real thing? Eating the real thing. I mean, do you lose a lot when you dehydrate?
You lose some vitamin C, but that's about it.
Wow.
So I don't, you know, the way we do it at low heat and as fresh as possible, and then we put them in these Myron jars, which are actually purple, not black.
Are they purple? Yeah.
Yeah. If you take an empty one and shine it to the light, you'll see it's the same purple apparently that was used in like medieval cathedrals to evoke a kind of spiritual awareness.
That's great. That's great.
Well,
boy, I'm out of turmeric and burdock. When are you getting those back in? Well, those are one of my two faves.
We're working on it.
Yeah, boy.
Yeah, I mean, for us, we have to make sure we get it from the right place. So we get our turmeric from Hawaii, and there's a guy who has this farm right on the Maui coast.
Wow.
And we got an email from him not so long ago, so I think we're
getting close.
We're on that one.
This Chola, Cholla. How do you say it? Cola?
Choya buds.
Choya buds. So this is good for blood sugar regulation?
Yes.
Wow.
It's a little bit of a tough thing to use. You have to soak it for about 24 hours to soften it up, and then you cook it like I wouldn't say, you know, one of the things we try to do is make this really taste good because that makes people want to do it. Choya buds, I wouldn't say taste that good.
No, they don't.
They have a kind of bland, asparagus-y, mushroomy kind of thing going. So I don't use them that much, but they're great in stir fries. You know, you just disguise it and it takes on whatever flavor the sauces or whatever.
I like to sprinkle some of them on fish, you know, and ooh, man, is it good. And you have the wild ramp back. Do you get is there any bacteria, good like friendly bacteria still around when you dehydrate?
You know, we're looking into that because, you know, we make these prototypes and, you know, we figure out whether we want to go bigger with whatever.
Right.
And, so I'm I have a big garden and so I make my own like sauerkraut and ginger carrots and stuff like that, fermented vegetables. And I happened I don't know where I got the idea, maybe from this Bar Tartine book, but I dried some sauerkraut. I thought it was a weird thing to do, but I tried it and it was the flavor was amazing. Amazing. It was. And a really easy way to eat sauerkraut. Now, the question is, you know, the reason you eat sauerkraut or reason anybody should eat sauerkraut is because of the good bacteria.
You're right. Yeah.
And so we're going to now work with these people at associated with Cornell who have a sort of state-of-the-art ag lab, and we're going to figure out what kind of bacteria actually make it through the drying process.
Oh, that's cool. Yeah.
And so if that works, then the hope is not that people then can use this like they use a probiotic now, but probiotics are not food. They're just bacteria.
Right.
And I don't think that's not right. You should be eating it in food, and if you can get sauerkraut powder, that would be great.
Yeah, we interviewed a fellow one time, Doc, that he was down in Africa testing all the poop, you know, and looking at the bacteria, and his whole conjecture was that all these different things they were eating provided a whole range of different friendly bacteria that we don't even get, like leeks and stuff like that. So,
yeah.
And maybe something to that. Yeah, maybe something to that.
Yeah, leeks are the, you know.
I love your leek powder. Oh, man.
Yeah, leek powder is the single best powder, in my opinion.
It's
not only
wonderful
because it makes the flavor of everything great. In fact, people should try getting creme fraiche or making creme fraiche, putting a whole bunch of leek powder and a little bit of salt, and then use it as a stir it up and use it as a like a dip for carrots or whatever, celery. It's just out of this world.
Try some of these. These are just so much fun, folks. They're just Dr. Cowan's Garden. Look on the front page of One Radio Network. And I don't know if you still got that first-time order thing. I think you do. Last time I talked to your son, you might try it, see if it's still in place. I think it's Patrick, a promo code. They give a little discount for the first-time order. These are really great things. Here's an email from LR. He is in New York. I ordered some wabanine from the place in that you mentioned first time you're on Patrick's show, and they sent me the liquid. Also, they sent me a little jar with these little white pellets in it. Does Dr. Cowan knows what these are, and could I use these in case of emergency? Have you seen those?
Yeah, the white pellets are a homeopathic version of strophanthus.
Yeah.
And my experience is you actually need, I mean, some people do fine with the homeopathic version, but most people need actually to take some wabain. And so the liquid, which is an extract of the seeds,
right,
we had tested for wabain content just to make sure how much was in there and it's the right species and all.
Yeah.
And it has about 1 milligram per milliliter, which that's sort of the, quote, right amount.
Mm-hmm.
Now, I've never tested the pellets. My guess is they wouldn't have any wabain in them. They're a homeopathic version of it, which doesn't, I'm not saying that's not, there's no help, but I don't rely on that because the kind of things that like I'm writing about and these practitioners are seeing and writing to me about improvements in ejection fraction and lessening of angina, I've never seen that with the homeopathic version. Or rarely, let's say.
Are people using the liquid in an emergency thing, like they would get in Europe back in the day?
Well, it's not IV.
And,
you know, sort of just off the cuff, I do have some particularly older patients and, you know, they've been through whatever, stents or bypasses.
Sure,
they just had enough. They're not going to the hospital.
They're not going back.
They're not going back, no matter what.
I'm not going back there.
So I've had occasion, not very many, people will call me up, oh, I'm having horrible chest pain, and I say, you know, well, you need to go to the ER. I'm not going. And I say, well, maybe you should go. No, not going. I don't care what you say. I'm not going. Okay. So in that situation, take, you know, whatever, 20, 30 drops every half an hour for 3 doses and call me back. And I've had a lot of those people, not a lot because there haven't been that many, but I've had occasions where they feel better. It goes away. And I always, and that's not a,
this is not medical advice, folks. This is just some experience.
It's not a comfortable situation. That's not my choice.
Right.
So I have seen that, and they did use it for that. You know, they used it IV, and they would break it like that. And
I wonder if you could use one of these little pellets as a homeopathic thing to help get the parasympathetic more happy, you think? I mean, would it be safe to try?
Could be, yeah.
I mean, it's just homeopathic, right?
Right.
Look at it.
I mean, what I'm hoping is that I get enough practitioners using it who have, you know, the access to instruments, heart rate variability or Vega machines or whatever else people are doing to assess parasympathetic integrity.
Mm-hmm.
And so then I can actually answer that question. I can't say that I see a lot from just people's symptomatic response. So, you know, I'm cautious about saying that's a good treatment for that.
But there appears to be these two little points right at the back of the skull, you know, behind the skull is a GB, I don't know. And I've been playing with that, and that seems to get us more parasympathetic. You know these two little points right there underneath?
Yeah, I know what you mean.
What's the name of that? Is it GB? I don't know, one of those things.
Yeah, I don't know.
People may look into that and try to play around with that. What are some things that you have found help people to get to more? These are one of the three, right? The parasympathetic, the arteries, and then the lactic. And we'll talk about all three before we go. Have you found some other things other than meditation and, you know, contemplation and just chilling out and not worrying about anything and talking to God to make the parasympathetic stronger? Any other things, outside things that you have found that work?
I mean, that's all about how you live and, financial stress, relationship stress.
And the whole deal, right? Life.
You know, you have to, you know, people have to connect with nature. They don't have to, but connect with nature and other people and not their screen. Screens are not people. And
I see the earth out there. Well, why is it then if folks start to worry or get anxious about this or that, that their heart rate gets a little silly? I mean, what's going on? Variable
because,
or fast?
Because the parasympathetic, the autonomic nervous system controls the heart rhythm and the heart rate.
Okay.
So if that's fairly straightforward,
just
if you're living in a sympathetic dominant situation, you're going to have trouble.
Mm-hmm. It just works like that, right? That's just what it does for a living.
Yeah, and if there's any right now, if there's any number one cause, I would say it's basically excessive electronic influence and not enough nature influence.
Oh, you mean the whole EMF thing, Doc, and what's going on there?
Well, not just EMF, but, you know.
Or just being on computers and all this
yeah,
stuff.
And, you know, I saw something the other day that the average adult checks their phone, I think, 54 times a day.
Oh, good.
The average teenager, 89 times a day.
Really?
Which means that most of your waking hours are your focus, at least to a certain extent, is on your phone.
Yeah.
That's a horrible way to live.
Deb wants to know, what are some things we can do or not do to decrease the lactic acid buildup in our heart?
Well, sympathetic, parasympathetic support, increased blood flow, not have diabetes, and eventually strophanthus, if it comes to that.
If you need it.
Yeah.
Yeah. My goodness. Well, is there any connection to the idea that the sap and everything goes up the trees and the way the whole heart works?
Yeah, I mean, I talked about in the book that there is very, you know, nature is very conservative in a sense of the mechanism of the sap going up in the tree is the same as the mechanism of blood flowing in the veins. And it's, I don't think we have time to get into that now, but it's got to do with the whole understanding of water and how water works and the fourth phase of water and these things that are not part of most scientific dialogue but really need to be because it really explains fluid mechanics and how fluids flow in any living system. So that includes people or trees.
Yeah, and you've explained to us before, I believe, something about the blood has a certain vibration or charge, and all the insides of the cells, the veins do as well, or the arteries, and then that's what makes the whole thing move?
Yeah, the water carries an electrical charge, which essentially creates the propulsion that is, quote, the pump.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Do folks that have had their chest cracked open years ago. Do they still do that to do stents, or do they have different ways to go in without cracking the chest?
Yeah, stent, you don't need to open the chest. You do that through the blood vessel. You just insert a catheter in the groin usually.
Mm-hmm.
Bypasses, you still need to open the chest.
So on bypasses, the people that open the chest, will those little corollary things rebuild?
To a certain extent, yes.
So they're always rebuilding?
Yes.
They're always. Well, that's good to know.
It is.
Do you have a theory on why these guys do get clogged up when they do?
Why people get plaque?
Plaque, right.
Yeah, plaque is most likely a consequence of chronic inflammation. That's the sort of general understanding now. Although, I would say that when you understand the principles of how water really works, there should be a protective gel layer lining the inside of the blood vessels. And my suspicion is when that's interfered with, that the blood vessels become exposed, and that's when they start getting inflamed. And so it goes back to how do we structure water in our circulation.
Mm-hmm.
And the two main things that help structure the water, besides potentially drinking structured water, is exposure to the sun and so-called earthing, or connecting to the electromagnetic field of the earth, both of which most people never do. They never earth, and they never, they're hardly out in the sun because the sun's bad for them, they think. And so when those two things don't happen, you don't form this protective gel layer inside of your blood vessels, and then they get inflamed, and then the body puts plaque in there to essentially seal the inflammation.
Wow, being out on the ground, just kind of being running around in nature.
Yeah, with bare feet.
Yeah. Gerald Pollack was on the show. He also suggested that perhaps saunas and things like that will structure the water in the body too, but he wasn't sure. His conjecture was.
Yes, saunas definitely are a prime, Pollack is right, that saunas do that. The question is which type of sauna, and I've been looking into that a lot lately, and I have some ideas, and we're probably going to go public with what we think is the best way to do that. But yes, Gerald Pollack is he knows more about this than anybody.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. And I think there's a lady, I forget her name now, or it's not coming to me, who talks about heat shock proteins and the benefit for the heart. A new study just out from Finland says that frequent sauna bathing reduces the risk of stroke, a 15-year follow-up study. 15 years.
Yeah.
Sauna four to seven times a week were 61% less likely to suffer stroke than those taking a sauna once a week. A large-scale study just now reported in Neurology. So,
yeah, I wouldn't be surprised. Sauna is one of the best things anybody can do for themselves.
So not only, I guess, there's good things for the detoxification, but these heat shock proteins, what's the lady's name? Well, whatever. They're good for the heart, these heat shock proteins?
Yeah, yeah. Right.
What do they do? What do they do?
Yeah, I don't know. I can't get into the connection of that in the heart. They're definitely a hot research thing because it has also to do with whole cancer therapy. But I can't get into that off the top of my head right now.
Gotcha. Okay, one final one. Mark writes in, I find Dr. Cowan makes perfect sense. My cardiologist referred me to a world-famous doctor who specializes in this condition. All I hear from these guys is medication and surgery. Not responded well to medication. I don't feel like I need surgery. Does Dr. Cowan, is he a practicing cardiologist? Does he still take on new patients or consult by phone?
So I'm not a cardiologist. I'm a general practitioner. I do take new patients, but they have to see me in person at least once. So that may be a complication.
Oh, that's the kind of the law thing, right?
Yeah, yeah, that's the law.
But once they see you in person, then you can do consultations.
Yeah.
Aren't you glad the government's looking out for us like that, Doc? It's good.
Yeah, very grateful.
Very excited. Dr. Cowan, thanks for being here, brother. We really appreciate your work. Now, your main website is Fourfold Healing, right?
Yeah, this one people really should check out. humanheartcosmicheart.com. That's got all the things related to the heart and even the products that we use, all of which besides Trifanthus are available to anybody. So I would check that one out as far as things on the heart, humanheartcosmicheart.com.
Mm-hmm.
And I would appreciate anybody using our stuff and buying the book and writing positive reviews on Amazon.
There you go. That's what always helps. Yeah. And we'll put all these links, the Heart Attack Noon, the Human Heart, and also your fourfold, and then
drcowansgarden.com, yes.
That's right. And we also have Dr. Cowan's link on our website, too, right there. All right, Doc. Can't wait till you get burdock and turmeric again, so I'll be looking for that.
You
take care of yourself. Thanks for your time, sir.
Okay, thank you. Bye-bye.
Dr. Thomas Cowan. Fun guy, eh? Well, I'm glad we were able to pull that off. Sorry that we had the internet thing, but I saw we just cut out about 2 minutes ago. They're still working on it, but it seems like it's pretty good. So I love you all very much. We're going to have fun tomorrow. We'll talk about a lot of things. We'll solve all the world's problems and four easy lessons tomorrow on Open Phone Friday. And we'll see you then. I love you all very much.
Broadcasting from the beautiful Hill Country in Texas, this is OneRadioNetwork.com.